Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to This Week in the Garden. I'm Peter Seabrook, here to exchange some news, views, a bit of seasonal advice and hopefully answer some of your gardening quandaries along the way. Now, it's some years since I took a hammer and broke up some pieces of broken pot to make crocks to fit for drainage in the bottom of big terracotta pots. I mean, once the Californian mixes of compost and then the all-P compost came in, of course we didn't need a crock over the bottom of the pot. It was only before then, when we were using John Innes and it had a fair bit of loam in it, there was a chance that a bit of clay could sit into that bottom hole on the big flower pots and just block it and make it waterlogged. And then of course once the soilless composts came in, In practice, plants grew better without the crocks. But lately, now we're moving to a lot of peat-free composts. There's a lot more soil being brought back in with a number of the mixes. And if you have got a big clay pot with just one large hole in the base, then it's worth getting a bit of old flower pot, preferably a bit that's just got a bit of a curve to it. Just one piece broken up and then slipped across the drainage hole just so the clay can't go in and block it up. Well, it looks as if the weather is at last on the change a bit and getting a little warmer, and with a bit of luck the bank holiday will be very comfortable. It has been helpful over the last few days to have the temperatures a bit warmer, and certainly the rain, quite heavy rain, has helped. But with some of the large flowered pansies that we've got in that really big trial, the wind and rain, and on Monday, quite a rough hailstorm, has damaged some of the petals. And so we need to do a bit more deadheading, a little bit more weeding. And then with warm weather, just 3 days, I would think, it's going to be absolutely spectacular at Hyde Hall. I was there today tying sweet peas. We were just growing a few cordon style. Flower buds are developing quite nicely. Stems about 9 inches long on those growing outside. And there were two ladies sitting on a bench. Well, for quite a long time, I didn't really take that much notice of them. But when they got up and I heard their footfall on the gravel as they came towards the exit, one of them said to me, "Thank you." And I said, "Thank you for what?" And they said, "Well, we were quite low and depressed when we came to the gardens today, and sitting in all this pansy colour has given us such a lift, and we're going home happy." Now, what more could a gardener want?
There is no better group of plants for flower power than forms of the shrubby potentate.
Our thanks for this week's sponsor, Hayloft Plants Limited, Pershore, Worcestershire. What's new? Well, I hear the Royal Horticultural Society, in their wisdom, have banned specialist fuchsia nurseries from exhibiting at their summer garden shows at places like Wisley and Harlow Carr because of fuchsia gall mite pest. It's very difficult to understand why they should eliminate fuchsias. I mean, they're still selling them on the garden centre, and there are cultural, insecticidal and biological means to control fuchsia gall mite. The cultural approach, if you see some of the leaves being bloated and twisted, you just cut the plant to the ground. Take everything away. Don't leave a leaf or any kind of shoot. And it needs to be burnt or, you know, certainly destroyed well away from any other fuchsia plant. And there are systemic insecticides you can use to control it. And more recently, a biological control. You know, you just release an insect that eats the gall mite. I mean, if they're going to ban fuchsias because of gall mite, where does it end? I mean, what happens with the Agapanthus gall mite or Hemerocallis gall mite or even blackcurrant beakbud? I mean, are all those things going to be banned too? I don't understand why that decision is made, well, or who made it. In spite of pretty grim weather, downpours, gale force wind and even hail, the interest in gardening continues to grow. The top plant sellers at present are zonal geraniums, petunias, begonias, tomatoes, of course, osteospermum, fuchsias and impatiens, busy Lizzie. 10 years ago, we were selling 100 million busy Lizzies each year. Boy, that's a lot of trowel holes, isn't it? And then, of course, downy mildew disease came in and pretty well wiped out busy Lizzies as a popular summer bedding plant. And then 2 years ago, new resistant cultivars were introduced, one called Beacon and the other Imara. And the sales of busy Lizzie plants are returning, although it's taking time, currently a quarter of what they were 10 years ago. What about timely tips? Well, the heavy rain has encouraged a slug and snail invasion. I thought my veg plot was pretty clear of slugs especially. But if I put a plant or two in black plastic pots on the dug soil, the chances are the next morning there'll be a slug or two underneath. What I'm doing is to just sprinkle a very few slug pellets, just two or three, under the pot. Because slugs and snails, of course, go in the dark during the daytime. And under the pot, the pellets are protected from rain, and so they last a little bit longer. And, of course, they're out of sight and reach of other creatures. So it makes the pellets last longer, and they're much more effective if you just put them under a tile or under a black plastic pot. Our guest on the podcast today is Dr. Sue Stewart-Smith. And one of the reasons I'm very keen to chat to her is that she's the author of a book called The Well-Gardened Mind, Rediscovering Nature in the Modern World. And I think a lot of us in recent months have come across people who've benefited from gardening to reduce stress. And Sue, with this book, looks to me to be well ahead of the field. Sue, welcome to the podcast, and may I congratulate you on a really excellent book.
Thank you very much, Peter, and I'm so delighted to be with you today.
Now, I'm not quite sure where to start. Could you explain why you wanted to write the book?
Well, there are actually several strands to that. I think, you know, one aspect was about my own experiences through gardening, because I started my gardening life as a bit of a gardening skeptic, as I put it. I married in my mid-20s Tom Stewart Smith, the garden designer, and we had this extraordinary opportunity of moving to Hertfordshire on his family plot and creating a garden in a field around the barn that we lived in. So for me, at the very beginning of, you know, I was determined to like gardening and love gardening because Tom was such a passionate gardener and I loved him. But actually, I did see it, I have to confess, a bit like outdoor housework. You know, I preferred being outside, but I didn't sort of see the intrinsic sort of value of it. Certainly not on a personal level. And that journey of beginning to make a space around us and then me, you know, after about 4 or 5 years of living here, beginning to grow some of our own food and growing herbs and things that I could cook with, really did hook me into gardening. And as my career became more, I think, you know, I became more senior as a psychiatrist and, you know, therefore taking more responsibility, carrying more work stress. I certainly realised that if I wasn't gardening at least part of the weekend, that I was feeling the sort of effects of that. I was missing it. So that was my own experience that I wanted to draw on. But the other aspect in the background was my grandfather's story that I'd grown up with. So there were sort of there were different inspirations that contributed to the book.
Well, so before we get on to your grandfather, which I found absolutely fascinating, why is it that going out and handling the soil does take you away from things? I mean, if I get up first thing in the morning and pop out to open the polytunnel to let in a bit of cool air, if I'm not careful, I'm there till lunchtime and the time has just evaporated. And after a really tough day, if I've been to meetings in London and things, if you get out into the garden, you're as if you're in another world.
I think that's exactly right. I think it is about entering another world. It's certainly how I feel. And like you, I can find I pop out just to do, maybe to pick something that I want, and I'm still out there a couple of hours later. What a lot of people talk about is feeling a sense of losing themselves in the garden. And I think, you know, one of the things that happens is that it's an experience that we can very easily get immersed in quite a sort of what we would call now a sort of mindful way, you know, in that sense of being very much in the present moment. And also caught up in a very, I think, gentle form of a relationship that's based on nurture and care. And one of the things I wanted to communicate in the book was the importance of that for our mental health, because actually our the way that the brain is configured in terms of caring is that it's associated with release of endorphins, for example, are natural opioids, so they have a calming, sort of pleasurable anti-stress effect on us. It's really hard to put it in a nutshell, Peter, because you know there are so many different levels on which gardening helps people. You know, right from the sort of very well proven effects of green nature on improving blood pressure and reducing heart rate, and actually decreasing levels of the stress hormone cortisol.
I've worked a little bit with one of the charities called Garden Leave. Ex-soldiers have had real stress problems. If we can get them into a walled garden where they have some protection to their backs and in with colleagues who've experienced similar difficulties, the recovery seems to be quite quick. I mean, is it a recovery or is it just a temporary improvement?
Well, I think you can't generalise about that. I think, as with all things, you need to have long enough of that therapeutic experience for it to become really embedded in someone's sort of, you know, recovery, if you like. But, you know, what you've touched on is a very important element of the therapeutics of gardens, which is the feeling of safety in that environment. The particular quality that many gardens have, and walled gardens have par excellence, is a feeling of being enclosed, as you say, not having to watch your back, but equally not feeling trapped or claustrophobic. You know, gardens have a lovely quality of openness and enclosure. And that's really the starting point for someone recovering from post-traumatic stress, for example.
Yeah. Well, now we have to get on to Ted May. How can we best hear that story from you, Sue? Can we hear it almost from the beginning?
Yes. I mean, I think when I started working on this book, I realised that I was drawing on that memory. And I went to my mother, she's now 93, and asked her to tell me as much as she could remember. What I'd grown up hearing was that how he had been captured as a very young man in Turkey in the spring of 1915. He was a wireless operator on a submarine, on the E-15 submarine, and that he'd really endured the most appalling captivity. And I later found that actually he was very lucky to survive. Something like 70% of the prisoners of war in Turkey didn't make it home. But when he did come home, which he did eventually after the end of the war, my grandmother was waiting for him, and she nursed him. And you know, he built his strength up a bit. But what really changed his life was getting the opportunity in 1920 to sign up for a year-long course of horticultural rehabilitation. And nobody at that point in the family knew where that had happened. And you know, Ted had died when I was 12. So Ted lived, you know, following his experiences, he lived a very healthy life and certainly didn't wear his traumas on his sleeve and loved his garden. He had a small holding and so you know, I remember his garden very vividly as a child. One of the things I wanted to do in researching the book was to try and find out where he'd had that experience, and I did find it, and it's a large house that was demolished, I think probably about 50 or 60 years ago, but from the sales particulars, I could see that it had a very extensive walled garden. And a remarkable number of glass houses, something like 10 glass houses, and some of them were heated. And that, for me, made sense of Ted's love of his own greenhouse and growing orchids. That was his other passion, apart from his veg growing, was his orchids. So the book for me was a journey, and I often felt, sort of, you know, the sadness of the fact that he was no longer there, that I could ask him what had happened. But at the same time, I wanted to honour his experience.
Well, you certainly do that. And it's a fascinating story. But your researches go much deeper than that. You go right back in history to examine and understand how tending things and gardening have improved people's mental state.
Yes, I think that was something that I also wanted to communicate, Peter, because you know, there's been such a growth of interest in contemporary research and science into the benefits of nature. It's very easy to sort of to focus mainly on that, and I do to some extent focus on that. But actually, these truths, you know, these great truths have been known for a very long time. And actually, one of the things I also wanted to explore was the very origins of cultivation. Because it didn't seem to make sense to me that gardening, if you like, came after farming, which is sort of somewhat of the received wisdom. And what I discovered in researching archaeology and anthropology was that there's a huge overlap. There's now increasingly sort of acknowledged to be a sort of what's one researcher called a vast middle ground between hunter-gatherer lifestyles and foraging and so on. And cultivation, and that there's quite a lot of evidence that in the late Paleolithic, people were living quite mixed lifestyles in certain parts of the world, and also that their cultivation was not for staple foods. They were growing life-enhancing herbs, maybe culturally important foods, dyes, medicines, all sorts of things, but it wasn't about survival, and I think that's very important, because gardening, I think, is fundamentally about life enhancement in various ways.
I was certainly interested to hear that the apple, as we understand it, came via the Romans with cyanwood just stuck into an apple fruit to keep it fresh. You know, so some of our gardening skills certainly go back.
Yeah, and, you know, also quite possibly, certainly the ethnographic evidence suggests, was also bound up with the practice of ritual and very early religions, that gardens were sacred spaces from very early on.
Yes, amazing, fascinating history for gardening, yeah, and for gardeners. But where are we going now in the future, do you think, Sue?
I think that last point about religion and the origins of religion in relation to the garden is still very, very relevant, because, you know, for all the, let's say, the anti-stress effects I was describing earlier that we can benefit from, there's also a level on which gardening helps people. You know, for some of them, they would acknowledge it as a spiritual level. For others, it's about a sense of meaning in life. You know, I think there's a lot of existential meaning to be found in gardening, because what we do when we garden is we get our hands in the soil, we connect with the source of life, we work with plants through the whole cycle of life. And that's, you know, it is fundamentally about the origins of life. And I think for many people, and some of them feature in the books, that people that I interviewed, you know, when it comes to recovering from a major bereavement or other forms of loss or a trauma, that sense of nature's working with nature's powers of renewal, but at the same time having to confront the inevitability of death and decay, if you like, that combination is very potent in terms of what it can offer people who may feel, you know, that there isn't a future anymore, for example.
Yes, you know, because I worry that gardens in suburban sense are getting smaller, and too many people are hard landscaping what little area they have. We have to turn that around, don't we?
I think we do, and there's a very shocking statistic at the end of my book about that, but also some other hopeful findings about how much urban and suburban gardens really can contribute to increasing biodiversity. And given the crisis that we're facing, I think, for me, that's one of the things I really hope that gardeners really do begin to take on board, is that actually planting for the pollinators and other insects and wildlife in the garden can be a significant contribution, particularly as our countrysides are becoming more and more depleted.
Well, now, Sue, can we underline the title of the book and where people can get it?
Well, it's just come out in paperback. It's on Kindle, and it's also an audio book read by me, which I managed to record just before the beginning of the pandemic. So it's available in all those different forms and from all major booksellers. It's always good to encourage people to use their local bookshop, and most of them should be stocking it, and if not, please order it through them.
So it's an absolute joy to chat to you today. And again, I congratulate you on the book. It's going to stay on my bookshelf and be referred to repeatedly. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Peter. It's really lovely to hear that.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
They say deaths come in threes, and I have received sad news of three departures this week. Captain David Barnes, who was died aged 91 or almost 91. He'd left the army in 1958 and married a Julie Pinkney, who was one of the Crisps in John Waterer and Son and Crisp. They had the famous Surrey nurseries and, of course, the Floral Mile along the A4 at Twyford. Built some enormous exhibits at Chelsea Flower Show with rhododendrons and azaleas, grown at Bagshot, and of course in those very early days, shipped into London by train and then by horse and cart onto site. They certainly built some really magnificent stands. Under Captain Barnes' experience, Waterers expanded into Dobbies of Edinburgh, They bought Dobbies in 1969, and when he moved up there onto that centre, they developed what was the second largest chain of garden centres. His son James followed, and then with a management buyout, he eventually sold to Tesco in 2008. So Captain David Barnes really did love his trees, shrubs, all of the hardy nursery stock, and was quite a character in the horticultural industry. From a different country, Renata Canali, he came from Italy in 1962 and has recently died, aged 79. When he came, first of all, he went to a nursery called Stuart Lowe in the Lee Valley and progressed there to become sales director. And that was a really big nursery, growing a tremendous lot of houseplants when houseplants were unbelievably popular. He had the vision to start a specimen tree and shrub nursery, and so in 1991 left Stuart Lowe's and set up Europlants in partnership with a really big Italian hardy nursery stock nursery, Venucci Pianti in Pistoia, and for 30 years built up a really big business in specimen trees and shrubs. In fact, one wondered at times what the big flower shows like Chelsea and Hampton Court would have been like without Renata's specimen plants populating a lot of those show gardens. Renata was a great character, tremendous supporter of the horticultural industry, and his open days, two open days every spring when the nursery was chock full of really beautiful trees and shrubs, he was very generous with his Italian hospitality. We all had a really good lunch there, I'll tell you. There was some excitement. Always a big auction and a lot of money raised for charity, including the Green Fingers charity. And he attracted customers from across the country. I will miss him tremendously. Yet whenever I called, always time to speak and always a smile from Renata. And the third, John Burrows, really an amazing fellow in terms of contacts throughout the seed trade. You know, he worked in his early days with a number of the big seed companies, Hearst, Sharps, Thompson and Morgan, and then set off on his own and had contacts really throughout the seed trade world. Somehow he used to find the smaller company breeders and introduced lots of novelty vegetables. I mean, this year, for example, we have the bush tomato, Sun Gold Super Sweet, which was one of John's findings. It will be a great memoriam to him. I think that cultivar is going to be here for a good few years. It's by far the best bush kind, very vigorous, needs a large pot or container, and one good plant, well grown, will have enough fruit, cherry size and delicious flavour, sweet and flavoursome, enough for a whole family. But it was all kinds of veg, shallots, garden peas, all the salad leaves and flowers. He was pretty good on sunflowers and introduced some really good short varieties. I don't believe that his knowledge, experience and enthusiasm for the seed trade will be matched. John, I'll miss you too. Great gaps now amongst my horticultural friends. My tailpiece, a quote from Francis Bacon. Nothing is more pleasant to the eye than green grass kept finely shorn. I could not agree more. But my lawn now needs a mowing. After repeated showers, it's been impossible to cut, and it's getting a bit too long. But with a bit of luck, this bank holiday week and some nice, warm, dry weather, our turf will be back to looking more pleasant to the eye. Hope to be back with you next week.
There is no
Our thanks for this week's sponsor, Hayloft Plants Limited, Pershore, Worcestershire. To my producer, Rich Jarman, and of course to you for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.